On paper, the labor market looks great today. The unemployment rate is at a historic low. Economists say anyone who wants a job has one or can get one. So then why do so many American families feel like this?
My husband and I had savings. We had established careers. We had our daughter 7.5 years ago when we were middle-aged already. But at that same time, we were buying our health insurance. We were freelancers. Journalism itself was in free fall. That was our industry, and it lost 50% of jobs since 2006. We just were going through our savings, and we were really concerned for the future.
Alyssa Quart spent the last few years, like Studs Terkel before her, traveling around the country, talking with all kinds of people about work. And what she found is a lot of us have jobs that look good on paper, but we feel squeezed.
I think I was probably most moved personally by the academics because I had been an adjunct professor and my parents had been community college professors and then regular professors. So when I was speaking to a number of different professors who were living close or below the poverty line, they were on food stamps. One adjunct who was homeless, who was living in her car, I talked to her. And more have come out to me, people who were journalists who were living in tents, all these out-of-work adjuncts who were also on food stamps and public assistance. I felt like I needed to tell their stories, and I was really wrenched by this feeling that people could no longer do what they love and that they were blaming themselves when all their hard work wasn't coming to fruition.
What got to me most were the stories about families. I mean, you talk about visiting a 24-hour daycare center.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a very powerful experience, just to be with those kids, feeling the love of these daycare operators who were also stretched really thin themselves. And then I looked at the numbers of that, and it was 9% of daycares are now at off hours, you know, at nights, Weekends, weird times in the morning.
You just wouldn't think there'd be that much need for 24-hour daycare.
The truth of it is that people are working very unusual hours now and multiple jobs, and we call them side hustles to try to make it sound more cute and likable. But side hustles mean that you're probably overworking and also very splintered in your daily activities. You might be working 20 hours one place and 20 hours another, right? That I saw a lot of. I saw people driving Uber nights, weekends, in the afternoon after teaching. They were school teachers, or school teachers who were painting houses after the last school bell because they couldn't afford their rent.
So your primary message for all of us is, anybody feeling squeezed, is it's not your fault. Do people think it is?
Yeah. I mean, I think people know on some level that there's all these systemic pressures, that middle-class life is 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. College tuition fees have jumped 35% from 2006 to 2016. People know this intellectually, but you can't help but think, why am I personally not making this work? Have I done something wrong? Am I immature? Have I not worked hard enough? And I think there's an ethos of 1% worship in this country, too. Worshipping the wealthiest, watching television shows about them, that kind of fools us into thinking that's the life that we should be living or that our neighbors are living, when really they may be struggling just as much as we are. But that kind of adds to the self-blame, right? Because you're watching these shows and you're looking at your social media feeds where someone found that statistically people post pictures of themselves in more expensive locales than they actually live. It's not an illusion. People are trying to look richer than they are online.
Yeah. And the level of self-blame and self-hatred, especially for this group we're talking about, I'm sure there are voices in their heads that are like, if you're smart enough to get a PhD, why aren't you smart enough to get a job?
Right, exactly. And some of the response to some of these character stories, the uncharitable responses often from people with very different attitudes about self-reliance, readers, they would write in, why are these people single? Some of them were single mothers. Not everyone in the book is a single mother, but there are a number. Why did they make sure they had a steady marriage before doing this? Or why did they get a degree in history and not in computer science? To me, it seems like there's a lot of blaming of others going on, as well as self-blame.
What was it like doing that reporting? I mean, you must have had to get to a point with them where they trusted you enough and felt comfortable enough to talk about things that they probably were hiding, in some cases, from friends and family members.
To me, that is my passion, really, as a writer, is to get to know people and to, I kind of sometimes feel like I disappear into their stories when I'm reporting. So maybe there was something about that that opened people up, made people feel a little reassured that I actually really wanted to hear. Like, I wasn't just trying to get it for a book. I wanted to know. I wanted to feel what they felt.
What do you tell people about how to stop blaming themselves?
I kept saying, and I started saying it to the subjects when I was interviewing them, this is a system failure, because I talked to a journalist who was just so angry at herself. She couldn't afford the soccer fees for her daughter, and they had to take in a roommate, and she was racking up debt. This is like so many subjects of this book. She said, I'm doing something wrong. She had been a reporter at a newspaper for 20 years. I said, no, you're not. This is a system failure. There should be support for you, and there should be some continuance of your professional life that makes sense. And those conversations, we can sort of have them with one another. But I think first we have to get over the shame and stigma that might prevent us from being open about the struggles that we're having.
How did she react when you said, oh, it's a system failure, it's not you?
The thing is, most of the people I was talking to would take it in and go, oh, yeah, yeah. But I didn't know whether they were really absorbing it. Some of them were politically motivated people who were activists, but I felt like even they would toggle back and forth between the sense of stigma and the sense of outrage.
And also, I think because the causes are so huge, it's hard to grasp. I'm not an economist.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a feeling too, that a lot of our economy is mystified, right?
Yeah.
Why is this happening to us? Why are wages not reflecting the fact that we have near full employment or that there's a record corporate wealth? What is the mechanism that's preventing this from happening?
Yeah, it feels like we got sold a bill of goods somehow. There were decades there where people kept saying, your career would be better if you just followed your passion and doesn't pay the bills.
We were sold a sort of post-60s idea of self-actualization, which was in response to a stable middle class, right, that was humdrum, that was like a prison that people wanted to escape. Now we'd want that banality back. We'd want to be on the train commuting half an hour rather than an hour and a half.
We wish we could be lifers.
Yeah, we wish we could be in Mad Men, in a sense. Like, some of those shows are actually fantasy spaces and not in the way people think. They're not just people acting badly. They're also a day that runs from 9 to 5 and is very cordoned off in a way.
You know, I think older people, I'm in my 50s, I think we're inclined to feel like we must have screwed up somewhere. How can I be more in debt now than I was in my 30s or 40s? Clearly, I didn't save enough. I didn't do the right things. But for younger people in their 20s and 30s, I think there must be a real sense of betrayal.
I'd like that to be the sense that they have. I would like people to vote along those lines. I'd like people to start organizing along those lines and say, oh, I'm 32, I can't afford to have a kid at all, which some of the millennials I spoke to expressed to me. I can't own property. You know, I'm not going to have a pension. I'm living with all this debt, $1.5 trillion in student debt now. And I'm mad, and I'm going to start aligning my interests with other people who are also precarious rather than with the wealthiest of this country.
So let's talk about solutions, because times are bad and there's a lot of pain. But you did find a lot of people, often even just on a community, neighborhood level, trying to band together, trying to invent new solutions, for example.
Among the bigger solutions, there were things like universal pre-K, subsidized daycare for people on the lower end of the middle class, not just people who are truly deemed needy. Universal basic income, which would be a monthly stipend, especially for, say, somebody with a disabled kid or somebody struggling without having a maternity leave. Mm-hmm. That $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month would actually be a huge difference for many of the people I met. There are things we can do for ourselves. We can create situations like co-parenting communities. I wrote about a few people who were not together romantically or biologically related, but they'd live in the same house and they'd serve meals and they'd do childcare for one another. Mm-hmm. So these are the kind of more bespoke things, and they can emerge when we stop blaming ourselves.
You're really talking about a stigma. And we've overcome others, and some we're still working on, like the stigma around mental health. How could we begin to approach erasing the stigma around financial struggle, economic struggle?
Well, I think the main way to lift that stigma is to normalize or naturalize these kind of conversations. In the Victorian era, people repressed sex, and then people repress death, and now they repress money. So that's sort of the, now I feel like people are repressing that. And there's no natural reason why we don't talk about money. People talked about money a lot more in previous eras, right? Or talked about class as a category. Hmm. So I feel like that could be shifted. It would just be people committed to coming out in a way as struggling. I do think of it as a coming out as normal in a way, and saying, this is what normal people are like. 80% of the population or 85% of the population is living like this.
So on a scale between hopeless and hopeful, pessimistic and optimistic, where are you?
I am very optimistic about people, because I think what people can do for themselves and one another is amazing. And it's sort of my, people are my chalice or whatever, my religion. Seriously, other people. But I am pessimistic about what our country is doing for its citizens and what it will continue to do. And that's the battle.
Well, thank you for your work. It's great. You made me feel much better that the bathroom ceiling is like completely falling apart and I don't have enough to call repair.
And you should
right
post
now.
It. Famous NPR host lives in
dilapidated home. Dilapidated house, definitely. All the other NPR hosts will be like, yep, me too. Anyway, thank you so much for talking.
Oh, yeah, it's great talking to you, too.
That's Alyssa Quart. Her book is called Squeezed: Why Our Families Can't Afford America.